You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Today's program was brought to you by TechServe. www.techserve.com.
Welcome to Why We Cook on heritageradionetwork.com. I am Erica Wides, chef instructor at the Institute of Culinary Education, and we're broadcasting live tonight from behind Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick, Brooklyn. So anytime you want to call in with a question or a comment to my show or any show on Heritage Radio Network, you can call us at 718-497-2128. We are live and we'd love to hear from you. Any questions, comments, anything you want to talk about related to food, you can call in. And you can also check out whywecook.com where you can look at some little transcripts from the show, check things out, send me a message. I'd love to hear from you also. So tonight, we're going to be talking about the homely, humble, forgotten root vegetables. The vegetables that are left to wither in the bin because nobody knows what to do with them. Things like rutabagas, turnips, celery root, salsify, Jerusalem artichokes, and parsnips. You probably don't even know what to do with half of those. So that's what we're going to talk about tonight for the first two segments of the show. And then the final segment tonight, I actually have a guest in the studio who is Claire Handelman. And Claire's a former student and friend of mine who is also a food blogger. And we're going to check in with her at the end of the show tonight to have a little state of the industry conversation, a little bitch fest, basically, from people who have worked for too long in restaurants and are a little bit fed up. And we're going to burst the bubble of the illusion a little bit. So stay tuned for that. There'll be a little controversy. So I'm sure everybody who listens to this knows who Michael Pollan is. How can you not? And Michael Pollan has a great line. It's the subtitle of one of his books, which is Eat Food, Mostly Plants, Not Too Much. And I like to take Michael Pollan's advice to heart. I think he pretty much knows what he's talking about. And if you've been listening to the show all summer, I've been on a real vegetable groove, talking a lot about vegetables, trying to eat more of them, cook more of them, trying to make that shift to not a vegetarian diet, but a very vegetable-heavy diet. Eat a lot less meat, a lot more vegetables. Not that I ever really ate a lot of meat, but trying to cut back even more. So we're going to talk about vegetables again because I feel like you can never talk about them too much. I think there's endless conversation to be had about vegetables. And since they're one of my favorite subjects, I decided to do another show on vegetables tonight. But there are some that really don't get the attention they deserve. They're the forgotten wallflowers, the shrinking violets of the vegetable world. And those are the roots and the tubers. Now, a couple weeks ago, I did a show where we talked about beets. Beets are definitely in that category, but because beets are kind of red and flashy and exciting, they get a little more attention than the kind of lumpy brown, dry-skinned vegetables like the parsnip, the celery root, the turnip. These are those vegetables that hang out, you know, in the root cellar and on the lower shelves of the produce market, and they get overshadowed by the flashier vegetables like the greens and the carrots and the tomatoes, the ones who are out there with all their colors, grabbing all the attention. And these are the ones that never get that, like, sexy misting shower in the supermarket because you don't want to get them wet. So they just quietly wait it out. They wait in those little bins down by the onions for somebody to appreciate them, somebody to recognize their true inner beauty. They're like the wallflowers of the vegetable world. They're waiting for someone to come along and really see them for who they are and not for the little gnarly dry skin lump that they look like. So as you know, I teach at a culinary school in Manhattan called ICE, and I teach in the professional, the career program. And right now I'm in the section of our curriculum where we do what I like to call swanky restaurant food, where we actually have the students work in groups and they create complete dishes that they then have to plate. So they get an opportunity to organize the food, to do their mise en place, to do all their prep, and then they have to execute the plates at specific times. So it's like they're practicing for their future lives of misery in restaurants. And they have to do an appetizer, and then they do a first entree, and then they do a second entree, and they have to follow time cues, and they have to make sure, you know, everything's hot and ready to go, and they have to plate identically so that everybody who orders the same thing at that table gets the same looking food. And in this section, we like to give them a little bit more of a challenge and make them work with things that maybe they've never seen before. So what I actually figured out this week as I'm going through it after having taught it several thousand times was that there's a lot of root vegetables involved. And partially we do that because you can get them all year round. And we teach our same curriculum all year round. So we can't do tomatoes in August and then do turnips in the winter. We have to keep it all the same. So just in this past sort of week, I noticed that on one of the day's menu, we did turnips that were cooked and then glazed in a vinegar and sugar combination called a gastrique. And that was kind of a revelation for some of the students. They'd either never eaten a turnip or they'd only ever had them kind of boiled and nasty. And then a couple days ago, we made a puree of parsnips with bacon fat and cream, and that was pretty great too. And that was used as a sauce for scallops, which is kind of an unusual combination, but really nice. And then today we did a puree of salsify and porcini mushrooms, which we used as a base for a seared steak. And salsify, if you don't know, is this kind of long, skinny root vegetable with dark brown or black skin, but it's white on the inside. Sometimes it's called an oyster plant. They eat it in Italy a lot. It's called scorzonera in Italy. So we pureed that with some mushrooms, and that was pretty great too. And so I started thinking, like, oh, these are such great vegetables, and they don't get the love they deserve. So let's do a show about those and, you know, talk about how you can use them effectively and creatively. And also, often, root vegetables are cheaper than a lot of other vegetables. So they're kind of good if you want to cook well, but you don't want to spend a lot of money. And since we're heading into cooler weather, or at least in theory, it's pretty warm out today, but it's starting to get a little cooler, and the tomatoes are definitely disappearing, and the corn is just about done, and I'm starting to see winter squash and apples pop up at the green market. It's a good time to talk about what we'll be eating for the next few months if we try to eat things seasonally. And you have to consider with these root vegetables that part of the reason why they're so great is because of their longevity factor, the fact that they can last for a long time in cold storage. Think about the fact that we've only really had modern refrigeration and home refrigerators for less than a century. People didn't really have refrigerators in their homes until the 20s or even the 30s in some places, and long-distance refrigerated hauling is only about 100 years old. So before that, it was grow it or buy it, eat it right away, or find a way to preserve it. That's why people figured out thousands of years ago all these techniques for curing and preserving food, like salting and smoking and pickling and making sauerkraut and all of that stuff. But with root vegetables, all you have to do is put them someplace cold and they keep forever. And they're actually in that group of vegetables that get better if they are left in the field until there's a little bit of frost. So farmers would pick everything else, but then leave some of the root vegetables, leave some of the cruciferous crops like Brussels sprouts, cabbages, because they all taste better when they get a little nipped by frost. Then you harvest them and you put them someplace cool, your root cellar, a hole dug in the ground, something, you know, under your house, under your barn, wherever you put it underground, it's always the same temperature. It's always cellar temperature, which is right around 56 degrees. And that's cold enough to prevent the vegetables from getting moldy or getting old or turning too starchy. So it was sort of the perfect arrangement. You dig all this stuff up in the fall after the first frost, you put it in your root cellar, and then you had food for the entire winter. And you can make your own little pretend root cellar too if you have a cold basement or a garage or something like that. Or what Alton Brown loves to do, I love him, he's one of my culinary heroes, is he takes the vegetable crisper drawer in his fridge and he fills it with sand, and then he buries all his root vegetables in there. So he makes like a mock root cellar. And you just keep them in there until you need them. So if you were living in Eastern France 200 years ago, you would probably have some duck confit, that, you know, duck that you cured in some fat. You'd have some sausages. You'd have some meat put away for the winter. And then you'd also have all your root vegetables and your sauerkraut and all of that stuff just chilling, waiting for you down there in the cellar until the middle of winter when you really needed it, when there was nothing else to eat, and then hopefully you put away enough of it to get you through. All of that stuff comes from needing to preserve food for the winter and get you through. So root vegetables are really key for that. So we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we're going to go on to specifics about some of these vegetables, how to cook them, what to do with them. We'll be right back on Why We Cook.
listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Today's program was brought to you by TechServe. www.techserve.com.
Welcome back to Why We Cook on heritageradionetwork.com. You know, you can listen to any show anytime on the network, archived forever, for eternity, anytime you want. You don't have to be sitting by your computer when the show comes on. And now we have podcasting too, so you can listen to any show podcasted also. But tonight we are live from the studio behind Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick. And because we're live, if you want to call in, you have any questions, comments, you can reach us at 718-497-2128. So now on to the specifics. We're talking tonight about root vegetables. I'm Erica Wides. I'm a chef instructor here in New York. And we're talking about root vegetables and how they have great longevity and how they're the underappreciated little wallflowers of the vegetable world. And there are so many of them, and they're all so, so good. But I knew I had to narrow it down because I always want to do too much on these shows, and I can never get to everything. So I had to focus on a few of my favorites. I had to pick three, even though it's like picking your favorite children. People claim you can't do it, but I think really people have favorite children. I'm not a parent, so I don't know. But I would have to say I would pick the parsnip, the sunchoke, and the turnip as my three favorites. Although, even as I say that, I feel a little ping for the rutabaga and the celery root. It's hard to say, but we're going to focus on those three. If I had enough time, I would get to all of those, but maybe we'll do another show on roots. Let me know if you find it interesting. I'll do roots part two. Okay, so let's start with the parsnip, one of my all-time favorite vegetables. So parsnips, if you don't even know what they are, they look like beige carrots. Maybe you've seen them in the store. They look a lot like a carrot, but they're beige. But they taste really different from carrots. They're a little bit peppery and very sweet, and they're starchier than carrots. They have a starchier texture. So one of the best ways to cook them is to chop them up, toss them with a little bit of oil or some kind of fat, and roast them because they caramelize and they get really sweet and really brown on the surface. And the inside gets kind of creamy and soft, not quite as starchy as a potato, but definitely starchier than a carrot. Roast them until they're really dark, really caramelized, then toss them with a few herbs, some sea salt. And they're great that way. They get crispy. They get really intensely sweet. And you can also roast them with carrots mixed in, too, for a contrast. And that's a really delicious way to do it. You can also simmer them in liquid, like in chicken stock or milk or cream, until they're really, really soft, and then puree them and make a soup. They make a really great soup. You could do like a parsnip and green apple soup, or like we did at work the other day. We did the parsnip sauce for the scallops, which was great. And you puree them. You can use them as a soup or as a sauce. And it's a really kind of nice way to get a vegetable onto the plate, but it also makes it really elegant and kind of silky and really nice looking. We did that sauce with scallops that had been seared until they were really deeply caramelized. And you kind of don't think that's like a real like surf and turf kind of thing to do a scallop with a parsnip, because parsnips are so earthy tasting and the scallops are so sweet. But it's a fantastic combination, so try it sometime. You can also boil them and mash them, just like mashed potatoes, or do a combination of potatoes and parsnips as a puree, and that's really great. But don't confuse the parsnip with the parsley root. You might come across parsley root in the store, especially sometimes you see parsley root around the Jewish holidays. It's not the same thing. Parsley root's really good, too, but they're very different. Parsley roots are just as versatile. You can treat them like any other root vegetable, but they have a different flavor. They have a much more pronounced parsley flavor, more herbaceous, less sweet. Although one time, years ago, there was a restaurant in Manhattan that's long gone called Verbena, and I did their vegetable tasting menu there, and I had a parsley root custard, a savory custard, and it was great. It was really delicate, beautiful, really nice. But then let's move on to one of the really quirky oddballs of all this, which is something called the sunchoke. You may know it as the Jerusalem artichoke. Now, technically, these aren't root vegetables. They're tubers. Like a potato is a tuber. A tuber is a little lump that grows off of the roots of a plant. right? So potato's not a root. It's a tuber. A carrot, a parsnip, they're roots. Sunchokes are tubers. And a lot of people know them as Jerusalem artichokes. But that name is really a misnomer. And it's confusing for people because, A, they're not from Jerusalem. And B, they're not artichokes, nor are they related to the artichoke at all. They're called that because they are the tubers that come from sunflower plants. And the Italian name for sunflower is girasol. And somebody a long time ago thought that girasol sounded like Jerusalem. And over decades, the name just wound up as Jerusalem instead of girasol. So Jerusalem artichoke's a weird name. I like to just call them sunchokes, which is a marketing name that I think is used pretty commonly. Anyway, that's what they are. So they're tubers from sunflower plants. They're not as starchy as some other tubers. They're certainly not as starchy as a potato. But they're interesting because they're crunchy and juicy, almost like a jicama. Jicama is sort of in that same group of vegetables. And you can eat them raw, which is nice. If you shave them or grate them really thin, toss them with a little vinaigrette, they're really nice raw, or cube it up and toss it in with other raw vegetables because they have really nice juicy crunch. But you can also cook them. And I like to chop them up and roast them like other root vegetables. But what I really like to do with them is make soup. And also what's great, if you're a little bit lazy and prep averse like I am, is that the skin on them is so thin you don't even have to peel it. You can just scrub the dirt off of them, chop them up, simmer them in some stock, some liquid, and puree, and you have soup. So they're really nice. They have a nice kind of crunchy, sweet, earthy flavor. Really good. Definitely underappreciated. Sometimes a little hard to find, although I have been seeing them at the farmer's market lately, so they're good. Give them a try. They really, what they need is somebody to give them a good PR campaign. They need some marketing. Someone has to get out there and plug the sunchoke. If any produce growers are out there and you're looking for a spokesperson, I'll do it. I'll be the campaigner for the sunchoke. Let me know. Okay, and then there's the last one I want to talk about, which is the turnip, because I don't want to run out of time, because in our third segment we have guests. We want to get talking to Claire. But the turnip, the humble little turnip. Did you ever hear the expression that somebody's a rube? You know someone who's kind of like a bumpkin and they call them a rube? Well, that comes from the German word for turnip, which is Reuben, or the expression, oh, he just fell off the turnip truck. Same idea. Calling someone a turnip is actually an insult. And I find that really offensive because turnips never did anything wrong to anybody. And I think they're probably pretty intelligent when it comes to vegetable sense. So let's change that. Let's give them a little PR spin too. They're so misunderstood and so underappreciated because I think people have only eaten them boiled. And vegetables in general, if you boil them, are nasty. But turnips are great. They're sweet. They're a little bit peppery. They're a little bit earthy. You can eat them raw, too. Same thing. Slice them up really thin or shave them really thin. And they're great raw. They're really crunchy. Nobody ever eats them raw. And they take to other flavors really well. So they're nice if you glaze them or roast them with other things, like with a little bit of port, some butter, maybe with a little bit of bacon. Bacon makes, you know, of course, everything good. And if you can find these little tiny Japanese turnips that show up in the market in the fall, they're great because, yet again, you don't have to peel them. And who really wants to spend your life peeling vegetables? So if the smaller turnips are available, get those because you don't have to peel. The bigger ones, the skin gets a little bit tough. You do have to peel them. And if you can get them with the greens attached, you get the twice as much for your dollar bonus that I love with vegetables because then you can cook your turnip greens like any other green and cut your turnips. Really nice way to cook a turnip, cut it into wedges, put it in a pan with some stock, a little bit of mirin, which is Japanese cooking wine, a little butter, a little shot of soy sauce, and just let it all cook. Cook it until the turnips are soft, and then let the liquid reduce down into a glaze, and you'll get this really nice combination of salty and buttery and sweet, and it coats the turnips, and it's great. This is a really great thing also to do with daikon. If you're familiar with daikon, it's that big, gigantic Asian radish, which is usually eaten raw, but is also really great cooked too. You can glaze the daikon and eat it the same way. Okay, so we're going to take another quick break. And when we come back in the third segment, we're going to talk with my guest today, who is Claire Handelman. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Today's program was brought to you by TechServe. www.techserve.com.
Welcome back to Why We Cook on heritageradionetwork.com. I'm Erica Wides, your host of Why We Cook. You can now check out whywecook.com and leave me a message. Check out the information I have on there. You can see some TV clips that have things I've done, whatever you want. Check it out. You can also become a fan of the show on Facebook. Go to Facebook and look for Why We Cook at Heritage Radio Network, and you can become a fan. I'd love to have you as a fan of the show. Also, we are live tonight, so if you're interested in calling in, 718-497-2128. We are live in Brooklyn, sitting here behind Roberta's Pizzeria, looking at people eating and getting very hungry. I'm getting hungry. So tonight I have a guest in the studio. I'm very excited to have her here. Her name's Claire Handelman, and she is a former student and now friend of mine. So welcome, Claire.
Thank you.
To the studio. And she lives right in the neighborhood, so it's convenient. And Claire is also a food blogger, and she has a great blog called Not Fine Dining. And you can find that at notfinedining.wordpress.com. And it sort of chronicles your eating adventures around the world, mm-hmm. right? It's some travel.
Some travel. I find cheap restaurants around the city of Brooklyn. Basically, anything that comes to my mind that strikes me and it deals with food, I'm going to write about it.
Yeah, and it's great. You should all check it out. It's really good. And this morning, when I was up at 6 o'clock getting ready to go to work, I was looking at my Facebook page, and Claire had posted something from her blog, which really struck a nerve and really struck home for me. Basically, you want to explain what you were talking about?
Sure. I decided to write an article because I've been having all these conversations lately with friends. You know, I've been catching up with everyone, and money seems to be like a real issue lately. And I just feel like all my friends that are cooks are overworked. You know, everyone's working 6-7 days a week. And it basically comes down to, because we don't make enough money to work in a kitchen. You know, you can't work 5 days a week and live.
And live on that.
You can't. Yeah. You know, you don't get paid enough money. So I wanted to write and make people aware of, you know, what a cook's life is like being in a mm-hmm. kitchen, you know?
Right. And this really kind of, I mean, it hit home for me because, you know, whatever, 17, 18 years ago, I decided this was what I wanted to do. It was a career change for me. I was 25. And it was a problem for me back then, too. I mean, in my first restaurant job, I was making $55 a shift. Mm-hmm. You know, and that wasn't hourly. That was a shift, no matter what time you came in and what time you left. And things haven't really improved very much. And because I teach in a culinary school where I have to be like a cheerleader for this industry all the time, it's really hard for me to see people, you know, people like you who are college educated, who are articulate, who are bright, who then say, you know what, this is my passion, this is what I love, and this is what I want to do, and go out there and wind up making $10 an hour, mm-hmm. $7 an hour, mm-hmm. you know. So you actually were describing this friend of yours, right, who's a pastry chef at a very high-end restaurant in New York.
Correct.
And how many hours a week does she work?
I mean, she probably works 80 plus. 80 she goes in on her days off. You know, she's just constantly there because there's so much work. It's, you know, they're one of the best restaurants in the city right now. So just with reservations, she just has to be there all the time, constantly churning out product.
Right. And that's not all paid time that she's there.
No,
right?
she's salary now. Yeah. So she's working even more. So she's probably, when it comes down to it, making less than she would be if she were hourly.
Right. It breaks down at nothing.
Right.
Hourly. And she's working at, you know, one of the top places in New York. They just got a 4-star review. Mm-hmm. They have this reputation for being very good to their employees and treating them well. Mm-hmm. But that's crazy how much she's working. But that's what happens.
And the thing that, like, again, like you say, really strikes a nerve is that they were busy before. You know, they're just consistently busy. And the cooks, you know, they make the same wage. But now that they've had the 4-star review, they're just insanely busy.
Packed, right.
And so while the cooks are working harder, they're working longer hours, they have to come in early. And, you know, you don't get paid when you come in early to the restaurant. You could come in 3 hours early.
That's what I used to do.
Yeah, yeah. And you don't get paid. And somehow that's fine.
Right.
But then front of the house, you know, they come same time, they set up, you know, they do their little side work, and they're making, you know, more than double.
Yeah.
You know, like, I found out that servers can easily pull in $2,000 a week at like a 4-star restaurant.
I know, it's crazy.
Where $2,000 a month is more than a cook
right.
would make.
Oh, I know. I mean, years ago, I was a sous chef in a 3-star restaurant in Manhattan, and I used to come in on my day off to work coat check because I made more money coat checking in a night than I actually made as a sous chef in a night. I know it's completely skewed and just totally unbalanced. And, you know, if you ask restaurateurs, you know, why it's like this, they say, well, labor costs are really, really high. And that's just how we have to do it. But I mean, there's got to be another way to do it. I feel like all I've been doing is sitting around bitching and complaining about this for years because nobody's changing the way that it happens. But, you know, why not tip out the kitchen?
No, there has to be some way, you know, and I feel like if someone like Danny Meyer has been so innovative and, you know, the cooks are definitely treated, I think, well in a Danny Meyer, you know, there's possibility of insurance, whatever. But when it comes down to it, like when you have a day off and you want to live your daily life, you know, maybe enjoy some time with your friends or have a weekend.
No, forget it.
It's pretty much impossible. Yeah. You know, you have to work 6-7 days a week.
Yeah.
You know, because you need the extra money because you're not making enough when you work 14 hours a day, 5 days a week.
Right. I mean, you have to know going into this field that you're not going to have the life you used to have if it's a career change or, you know, you're not. We work when everyone else plays, you know, holidays, weekends, nights, when everybody else wants to go out, you're going to be there working because that's where they want to go. And I mean, I try to be realistic about it when I teach and say to my students, you know, you have to understand what you're getting into. You have to know that your life is going to change dramatically. And if this is a career change for you, you're probably going to make significantly less money than you used to make. And you're going to be on your feet and it's going to be really hard on your body.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an industry that is brutal to its people. And the people who make it are the people who can really tough it out, who can take it. But I think what's wrong, you know, what's going on now is like the Food Network and all these shows. And it's also glamorous and exciting that, you know, we get all these students coming in. I mean, you were how many years out of college when you started school?
I was 2.
Okay, so you had worked in something else before or not really?
Not, you know, I kind of traveled for a while, like trying to figure out. It was traveling that really actually sparked, you know, I was trying to figure out what to do after college and it was like, I focus on food, I focus on ingredients, I'm going to make this part of my life.
Right. Yeah, and, you know, I get students now who are in their 30s and their 40s, you know, people who have, you know, really nice lives and jobs and everything. And I just want to, like, shake them. I just want to say to them, like, don't do it.
Well, because they think it's glamorous.
They think it's glamorous or it's their passion.
But this is the other thing because this is what people think our job is. People think that we're making money, you know, especially since we work at, you know, some of the best restaurants in the city. People are like, oh, you know, you must make great wages.
Right.
And it's like, it's so far from that. You know, I think it would be nice to make people aware of this situation because I think if you could get support behind this, you know, because people just don't know. They don't know that a cook doesn't make any money.
Right, and that it's almost like an inverse ratio. At like the higher end and more expensive the restaurant is, the less the cooks are actually getting paid.
Mm-hmm.
Like you'll make more going, you know, to work at, you know, the Marriott in Secaucus, you know, in their banquet kitchen, than you will if you go work at a place like Per Se. And that's because there's this whole culture of like, oh, well, it's a privilege for you to work here, you know, and half the people in the kitchen are probably working for free.
Right.
You know, which is sort of the big scam of the extern.
Yeah.
You know, we send students out on extern and they have to work for free for 6 weeks or in some places even longer. Yeah. Yeah, so I, you know, I think that what you wrote in your blog is really important. I mean, people have been saying this for a long time, but you put it very well. And, you know, to use the example of your friend who's a pastry sous chef, that part of it, too, is when you're a cook and you're put in this position of responsibility, we tend to be very responsible people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not like in a regular job where you can call in sick and someone can cover and it's not really a big deal. It's like if you run a station in a restaurant and you're sick.
It's too bad.
Too bad. Yeah. You still come in. Which is another really screwed up thing about the industry is that you come in and so, you know, your friend knows that there's all this work that has to be done. She has to get it done. And so she comes in no matter what. Like, you get it done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's...
But that's also, that's the passion behind it. Because I think most people that are in kitchens aren't doing it as a job. They're doing it because they love what they do.
Right.
You know, and like, even for myself, I'm so passionate about it. And I've only recently just really cared about the money thing because I took a look at my friend and I was like, this is just insane that a person working front of the house is now benefiting so much more from a 4-star mm-hmm. review mm-hmm. and nothing's changed in the kitchen. You yeah. know, no cook's wages are going up. You know, they're not no. getting a bonus.
They're actually going down, I think, sort of if you look at it in proportion to, you know, cost of living or even, you know, based on real dollars.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think they're going down.
So now I guess just at this point, it's just kind of upsetting. Like, I still love being a cook. I love everything about it, the creativity, you know, the camaraderie in right. the kitchen.
Teamwork, yeah.
Everything about it I love, and I wouldn't not do it. I just think it'd be really nice if they could figure out some way to, like, show yeah. a little love to the kitchen.
Well, factor the cooks in. I think I remember hearing that at Per Se, the cooks get tipped out. They get some sort of
I have heard proportion. That some kitchens are trying to do it, but I know yeah. that they've also had issues, like, front of the house complaining
right.
that they don't want to tip out.
Right, which is ridiculous. I mean, I've worked both, you know, I've worked yeah. front and back of the house. And I mean, yeah, frankly, you know, you want to keep your cash, but those are the people who are making you look good,
mm-hmm.
you know. In one place I worked years ago, we actually had a system where every night each waiter put, like, I don't know, $1 or something into a pot. And then every 6 weeks we divided it up in the kitchen. And I was making so little money at the time that, you know, after 6 weeks, I think I got like $50 or something. And I was mm-hmm. so excited. It was... which was ridiculous. But anyway, let's talk a little bit more about your blog. You just spent how many months traveling?
I did 6 weeks in China. And then just before that, I did 3 months in Africa.
Oh, right. In Africa. So what's the food scene in Africa like? I mean, let's stop bitching about the industry now and end on a positive note. So uh-huh. can you just kind of like give us an overview of what the food in Africa was like?
Yeah. I mean, the whole reason I travel is for food.
Yeah.
Because I want to taste right. everything. And Africa was
what other reason is there to travel?
You know, museums, some nah. art. But for me, it's definitely the food and the people. But Africa was really very similar. I went up the eastern coast from Cape Town to Cairo. And most was, you know, a root cassava, actually. Mm-hmm. And so they would turn that into a powder and then, like, reconstitute it. Kind of like polenta.
Yeah.
Except they don't season it. And then you'd eat, you know, a fish that was fried. And it was all, like, very heavy food meant to, like, give you sustenance.
Yeah, enough calories
to yeah, survive, right? It wasn't so much for flavor. So actually, most of Africa, I was eating tons of mangoes, passion fruit, you know, just fruit that was in abundance and really inexpensive. But then when I got to Tanzania and Ethiopia, those and Egypt even, those mm-hmm. foods were just more flavorful. Mm-hmm. They have the Arabic influence.
Right.
There's just more spices incorporated into the food. So once I got, I guess, halfway through the continent, food became really exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And then Egypt, you know, you have Mediterranean.
Right.
Pickled vegetables.
Right, the whole Middle Eastern influence. And they also, because they're closer to sort of Europe and the Middle East, they, you know, they have access to more mm-hmm. ingredients. And yes. there's more affluence. I mean, the further north you go in Africa,
correct.
People are slightly more.
Ethiopia I was actually so excited about because I love the injera, the
yeah,
spongy sour bread. I love
so
it.
So good.
And, you know, I was kind of excited to have it every day until I realized that that's basically all they eat there.
Mm-hmm.
Every single meal is injera. And the only day that you really get vegetables is on a Wednesday or a Friday, which is considered a fasting day.
Mm.
So on those days, you have, like, what we know as Ethiopian food here with, you know, the tons of different vegetables, like
right.
lentils, kind of curry-esque vegetables
yeah.
prepared. And that's amazing. But every other day, it's really heavy, like lamb stews,
huh.
like tons of oil. And it was delicious, but after 3 weeks of that, it was like, I need some other kind of food
yeah,
now.
Yeah, I know. I remember reading your blog while you were traveling and being surprised by that. Because, yeah, when we go eat Ethiopian food here, it's a lot of vegetables and
mm-hmm.
grains and legumes and, you know, which I love.
Right.
But,
no,
yeah,
I love
like
too.
So much. Yeah.
But that's not the norm. That's only the 2 days a week when they're fasting.
Oh,
and then every other day is the meat.
So it's just it's like a meat-free fast. It's like a Friday Catholic
yes.
kind of thing.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really interesting.
That food was interesting. I mean, Africa was just interesting. The food was different. They had fruits that I had never seen
mm-hmm.
before.
Did you try the miracle fruit?
Oh,
you know,
which one
fruit?
Is that?
It's this berry that you, when oh, you eat it, it makes everything really
No, where does
sweet.
That come from?
You know, I don't know, somewhere in Africa.
Yeah.
I don't remember. I went to a tasting where we all tasted them, and then you, like, you'll eat this little berry, and then you eat a lemon, and the lemon tastes really, really sweet.
Yeah.
It tastes like lemonade.
I've heard of it.
Yeah,
I didn't.
It's pretty cool. Yeah.
But they had lots of different fruits. Like, there was this one fruit that I kept passing on the streets in Tanzania, and I kept thinking it was black olives. Women would have these huge plates of what I thought were black olives.
Mm.
Until one night I sit down at a restaurant, and this man is like, you have to have this drink. he brings it out and it's like magenta, hot pink, purple, you know, it's just crazy colors. And it's actually the fruit that looked like an olive. He brought it out to me. I bit into it and it was the exact same color as the drink. It's just like an unworldly color. It was
beautiful.
And it's
really sweet.
Really sweet. When you eat it like off the fruit, it's really tannic. It makes your mouth feel like you took a big, you know, swig of dry wine.
Right.
Sweet, but dry. Mm. And then when you blend it for some reason and freeze it, it was just really sweet and delicious.
Sounds really good.
Yeah. So it's like stuff like that. It's exciting to see.
Yeah. I mean, that's what, you know, that's what drives people who are into food is like going places and tasting all of that stuff. And that's what I think brings a lot of people back around and into the industry because they have that passion and they're driven, you know, that way. But, boy, you know, once you're out there and you're trying to make a living at it, it really, really can suck. But anyway, and on a positive note, we are just about out of time. So we're going to wrap it up. But if people want to check out Claire's blog, it is notfinedining.wordpress.com. And you have been listening tonight to Why We Cook on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Erica Wides. You can listen anytime, podcasted or archived. And we'll see you next week. Thanks for joining us.